do one talk, and I can do it every time I come to Singapore. So this time I was going to talk about karma, and in some ways is my least favorite topic, because usually when I do a talk on something, I like to be clear, I like to be bold. You know, in the old days when they had an army going to battle, the most important position was the trumpeter, and the trumpeter would blow these big strong trumpets. And they had to be good, because if you blow the trumpet and it goes, and then your army is walking into battle like this, and then they don't fight very well, so you need a really good strong trumpeter. And in many ways, a Dhamma, when you're doing a Dhamma talk, you have to be the same. It's not that I or the other speakers are the great leader, but you're the one that's in front. So you have to take the job. It's a bit like penguins. Have you ever seen penguins? they all gather on the edge of the ice, right? And the one penguin will go up to the edge of the ice, and he'll go, I'm going to jump in. No, I'm not. And then I'm going to go. Then a couple of others are going to come over, and they say, No, I'm not going in yet. And then a few more come, until there's about 40 or 50 of them, and they all keep going like this. And then sooner or later, one of them just falls over, jumps in the water. And as soon as that first penguin goes in, you know what happens? You've seen videos of this? You have to look it up on YouTube, Penguins. March of the Penguins, fabulous movie, you should see that. Once the one penguin goes in, all the other penguins go in, boom, 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 boom. And sometimes a whole chain of them, 50, 100 of them, and they're all scared, and then once the one has gone in, they all go piling in after. And that's what it's like being up on the stage as a Dhamma speaker. You're the first penguin in. You're not nothing special. You're just the first one in, and then everyone else will jump in after you. The reason for it, by the way, is there are leopard seals, and the leopard seals wait at the edge of the ice like this, and they're waiting for the first penguin. So the first penguin that goes in gets gobbled. All the other penguins go in after, because they know if there's any seals around, they're busy eating the first penguin. So that's me, I'm the first penguin in. So when I do talks, then I like to be clear, I like to be definite, I like to look people in the eyes like this. And I can do that because it's not my teaching. That's the great thing, you see, it's the Buddha's teaching, it's not mine. If you don't like it or you disagree, you know, it's not my problem, you know. You don't send your complaints to me. But when we talk about karma, it's a little different, because I've read all about karma, and I still don't understand it. I still don't honestly understand quite what the original teaching is. And we get snippets and we get bits and pieces. And you may know that the Buddha said karma is an imponderable, something that you can't figure out. And it's no good for people like me, because I like to figure stuff out. And he said, you can't figure it out. Before you figure out karma, your head will crack into 7 pieces. There's a few things, if you can remember. I think the mind of a Buddha, the mind of jhana, you can't figure out. Karma, you can't figure out. There's a fourth one. Anyone remember the fourth one? I can't remember. I think it's the opposite sex or something. You can never figure out. So karma was one of these imponderables. Doesn't matter how much you think about it, you're not going to work it out. So what we have instead are just some basic rules of thumb that we were advised about. So we are supposed to believe in karma. I think that's interesting, because there are very few things in Buddhism that you're asked to believe. Like most things, you're supposed to work out, you're supposed to experience. But there's a few things called right view, samadhi. There's a few things that you're supposed to actually believe and accept. And if you don't accept them, then it's quite likely you're going to go onto the wrong course. And one of them is karma. we're supposed to accept that there is karma, there is the fruit of doing good deeds, there is the fruit of doing moral deeds, fruit being both good and bad. And that's it. The explanation doesn't go very much further than that. And throughout the suttas, there are some little bits and pieces, certain times, certain places where you get some explanations or some similes, some metaphors. So I'm going to raise one example. One man, I think he was in Serbia or somewhere, he won the lottery. And he's ecstatic that he won the lottery. And quite unusually, the first thing he did after winning the lottery is he ran to the monastery to give thanks to God. You know, thank you for making me win the lottery. And while he was there, just as he came out of the monastery or the temple, the big icon on the top of the wall of the monastery fell off and killed him. At least he died rich, right? You know. Now, you hear stories like that, and it seems, you know, that can't be coincidence. Or can it? I don't know. What do you think? Was karma playing a trick on him here? Was this something karma? Is this pure chance? Is it pure luck and bad luck? To have the extremes of, like, the ultimate extreme of good luck and bad luck in the same afternoon. I mean, that's quite unusual. Is this karma acting here? What do you think? Anybody have an idea? Would you attribute this to karma? No, don't know, not sure. Probably a few people nodding. They say your last moments of dying are supposed to be very important. So, I mean, at least this guy was happy when he died, you know. Maybe he had the karma to die, but he had the good karma to die happy. So the lady karma gave him the lottery, so at least that he would die cheerful. I have one friend, he gives the example of Robin Hood. And he says, you know, Robin Hood, he would steal all this stuff and he'd give it to the poor people. He made really good karma by giving it to the good people. He said, but he stole the stuff, which is bad karma. And this is why all the people loved him, but he never had any peace because he was being chased by the Sheriff of Nottingham. So your good and your bad karma coming to play. It's very hard to tell when something happens, especially when it happens to yourself or someone close to yourself. Is this occurring because of karma or not? And usually, if something bad happens, we like to attribute it to karma. And if something good happens, we like to attribute it to ourselves. In psychology, this is called the fundamental attribution error. And the fundamental attribution error says that if something good happens to you, you think it's because of your own good qualities. If something good happens to somebody else, you think it's due to good luck. If something bad happens to you, you attribute that to bad luck. If something bad happens to somebody else, you say that's because of their bad qualities. They deserved it, kind of thing. And it's true, people really do think like this. One example is thieves. Will always think that if they're a good thief, they won't get caught. And then they'll see another thief and they'll say, well, they got caught because they weren't really good at it. But I'm good at it, so I'm not going to get caught. So you're buying into a self-delusion that your own qualities can change your outcome. Obviously, after a period of time, you're most likely going to get caught. So if I do a talk and people say, oh, that was a really good talk, I'm like, well, you know, I've got good qualities, you know. But if someone says, yeah, it was a terrible talk, that one, and, well, the air conditioning was no good, and the microphone, and, like, people, and, like, well, I'd had a bad day, and you know, it's not my fault, right? And vice versa with somebody else, you know. Somebody else passes an exam, and you think, well, the exam must be really easy. and they fail in the exam, and you say, well, you know, you're just not very clever, are you? So the fundamental attribution error, we tend to look for karma when something bad happens to us. And when something good happens to us, you're like, hey, we don't care about karma, I'm going to spend my lottery money or whatever it is. So we have to be a little bit careful and of what we attribute to karma and what we don't attribute to karma. Now, I had one Sri Lankan friend. He was a monk in Bangkok, and he had a hernia of the stomach where the intestines kind of break the wall of the stomach internally. It's nasty, but it's not serious. You know, they push it all back in and they staple your stomach up, and it's all right. You know, it's not serious. Any operation is fairly serious, of course, but it's not a life-threatening illness. And afterwards, he had all these pains in his body, and he went back to the hospital. And for the monks in Bangkok, we go to the free hospital because it's free. And free hospitals and paid hospitals have a very different philosophy. And the paid-for hospitals, they always want to give you a treatment. And the free hospitals, they never want to give you a treatment. I like the free hospitals, because any doctor who says to me, ah, just leave it, I'm like, I like that. Any hospital that says, you know, you've got to have this operation, I'm like, I'm going to the other place. I don't like that. So he went back to the hospital saying that he was in pain. And they said, okay, take these tablets. And then he went and got the tablets from the pharmacy there, and they were painkillers. And that wasn't, you know, wasn't very satisfying. So it went on a little bit longer, and he started to get in a lot of pain, especially all of his lower organs from here downwards. And so he went back two or three times, and every time they just gave him more painkillers and said, you just leave it, it's healing up, we've operated on you, you know, it's all right. And so I took him to a different hospital, and this is a government hospital that is kind of semi-private, semi-public, but they treat monks for free. So I took him there, and it's a fairly good hospital, but you do have to wait a long time. And so they took one look at him and said, oh, you can't live like that. And what had happened is all of his organs had filled up with fluid. And so he had the waterlogged all of his organs down here. And you can't stay like that. And the next morning he was in, and he had an operation, and they had to drain all this fluid out. They had to reopen where his stomach had been stapled and stitch him up again. And after that, he was fine. So was that his karma? What do you think? I do Abhidhamma in Bangkok. And has anyone done Abhidhamma here? No, a little bit. Okay. If anything can really make your head crack into seven pieces, it's Abhidhamma, I think. And so I asked my Abhidhamma teacher, and he said, and I really like him, he's a good teacher, he said to me that, well, maybe a previous time in this life or another life, this monk had like tortured a creature, tortured some animal, but in the end he'd let the animal go. And he said, so now he gets the, you know, the illness, but after a while, you know, he's free from it. And to my mind, that's pure speculation, right? You don't know. We don't know what happened. And to be fair to my Abhidhamma teacher, he just said, like, somewhat, which means, like, imagine, or we can imagine something like that. Now, the Buddha said that some things can be, with bodily illnesses, he said, some things can be attributed to karma. Some things can be attributed to the humours. Not quite sure what the humours are, but the energy forces or the chi, you might say, something like that. Some things can be attributed to the bodily winds. Some things can be attributed to the seasons. Some things by not looking after your body properly. Some things can be attributed to attacks. And I don't know what that means. I don't mean if somebody attacks you. I mean, And some things can be attributed to karma. So the point is that when these kind of things happen to you, really you don't know whether that's karma or not karma. Could be anything, really. You win the lottery, you know, well, is that, it's probably not your, not because you deserve it. There was a story of a Jewish man, could be anybody, but it was a joke about a Jewish man, and he asked God, he said, please, can you make me win the lottery? I really deserve it. And the clouds parted, and the skies darkened, and a big light shone through, and a voice boomed through, and God said, okay. So a few months go by, and nothing. He didn't win the lottery. So he's walking along the same road, and he says, now, God, you promised me that you'd make me win the lottery. So the skies darkened, the clouds parted, the light comes through, and this voice said, meet me halfway and buy a ticket. So we don't know. If you win the lottery, you don't know. You know, you won it because you bought a ticket, probably. It's not so sure about whether it's your karma or not. In New Zealand, they have these luckiest lottery ticket shops in New Zealand. And there's one shop that had a winning lottery ticket 4 times. People drive for hundreds of miles to buy a ticket from there. And it's not surprising that they actually are so lucky, because like 20% of the population buy their tickets from that shop. So the odds start increasing that they're actually going to have the winning ticket, right? There's one thing that I have observed in the suttas, and that is that whenever we talk about karma in the suttas, we only ever talk about karma affecting the future. You never find karma being the past affecting your present. And this is a slightly subtle point that I wanted to illustrate. Normally when I do the topic of karma, I have 4 talks on karma. And this one's, I can't remember, the second or the third one. But I'm presuming that you're all experts in Buddhism here. You all know your stuff. So we're jumping in at the deep end a little bit. So I'm skipping past some of the questions of exactly what is karma, what isn't karma, whether karma is purely mental or whether it can be physical, whether karma can be outside things hitting you, or you know, if you have your car stolen, is that due to your karma or is that because you left the keys in and the door open? I mean, these kinds of questions that people like to bring up whenever you talk about karma. And actually, last time I did the talk on karma in Bangkok, and people love to like raise these ridiculous questions and kind of expect me to have an answer. So one man, he said, all right, he's like, he said, so if you were in a room with Hitler, I'm like, oh, here we go. If you were in a room with Hitler and you had a gun and you could kill him, and you had the chance, and you knew what Hitler was going to do to the world, but you know it's bad karma to kill him, now what would you do? Now I would do what any red-blooded, democratic, free-thinking, upward, meat-eating, true-blooded bulldog Englishman would do in that situation. I would hand Mr. Hitler a letter of complaint. These kind of questions you can't answer, right? And when we talk about karma, most people like to bring up these impossible situations. Another man, he said, so if you're in a zoo and a baby falls into the crocodile pit, I'm like, here we go again. He said, do you jump in and kill the crocodile, which is bad karma for killing the crocodile but saving the baby, or do you leave the baby? I'm like, man, I don't know. I don't go to the zoo. I'm I don't know what I'd do. I really don't. In fact, there was one man in New Zealand. I used to live in New Zealand. I have a lot. Anybody from New Zealand? No, good. And there was one man that was in the newspapers, and there was somebody being attacked by a shark. And you know what this guy did? Said to his wife, he said, "Hand me my cricket bat." And then he jumped into the sea and he beat the shark off with his cricket bat. And that's a brave man. I think that's good karma he's making there. These kind of situations, I really don't know what I would do. So I want to put aside some of those kinds of questions, like what is good karma, what is bad karma, whether when something happens to you, is that your karma, is that not your karma? That's all in another talk. This particular time, what I wanted to talk about was this thing that I noticed in the suttas, that karma was always from the present to the future and never from the past to the present. And it's a slightly subtle point to grasp. That's in the suttas themselves, and I like to go back to the suttas as my core. That to me is the original teaching. That's the base and the foundation. I like to bring other things in. Psychology is one of my favorites. I'm a psychologist by my degree. In the commentaries to the suttas, the commentaries always talk about the past affecting the present. So something happens in the suttas, and then the commentary will attribute it to something in the past. So, for example, Moggallana, the Buddha's right-hand man, was killed by robbers who came into his kutti, his hut. And I think the first couple of times that they came in, he used his psychic powers and he levitated into the rafters. And then I think the third time they came in, he's like, well, it's my karma, and so the robbers killed him. And the commentaries attribute that to his karma. That was his karma to be killed by those people. Now, I'm a little bit suspicious of the commentarial tradition. There's some great things in the commentaries, but also the commentaries are not the word of the Buddha. And the Buddha himself never talked about things as being past karma, or very rarely talked about things of the past karma affecting you now. If you note, if you take a look, you always see that I'm the owner of my karma, the heir to my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, of that I will be the heir. Forward looking, looking in the future. What I do now will affect the future. So we have two things in karma. We have karma and vipaka karma. Karma, or we should say kamma, actually. Three words. Karma, and kamma. And karma and kamma are the same, but karma means lust. So you have to be careful on that one. If you come to the temple and say, "My karma is really bad today, Venerable, what should I do?" Oh, yeah, I don't. Make sure you get your word right. So karma, K long A M A, is actually lust or sensual desire. Kamma means action, and kamma means the actions that you make. Really, it means your intentional actions or your deliberate actions. Vipaka kamma means the results of your actions. So if something occurs because of what you've done in the past, that is vipaka kamma. That is your karma catching up with you and giving you a beating in most cases. But karma itself on its own means your present action. It doesn't mean something that you've done in the past affecting you now. Now, I can give you one example of karma as perception, which is my particular area of interest, being a psychologist. Note, this isn't the only way to think about karma. If you're an expert, you might disagree with this, and I fully accept that. There are different ways that you can think about and understand karma. But one of them is perception. So if you, for example, you see a Buddha image, what is your perception of the Buddha image? What do you see? You don't actually see the image. What you see is your impression of the image. What you see is your ideas. In psychology, we call these constructs. You see your construct of the image. You don't see the image itself. So, for example, if he has studied Buddhist art, he'll come in and he'll see this is a it's not a Thai image. I'm not quite sure what it is, Sri Lankan image. Because the top knot doesn't have the flame on the top. That's a very Thai thing. The robes go over both shoulders equally. If it was a Thai image, the old ones have a single strip down here to show the Sanghati with a slight V on the bottom. Then the V's change. The strips came longer down, higher up. The curls were smaller or larger depending on where it comes from. And very often the art was governed by the material that they were making things out of. So when they were making images out of graphite, they couldn't have hands, for example, because they would just fall off. So the hand would have to be, you know, part of the body. So a lot of the imagery was determined by what you're actually making the image out of. Sometimes they would mold the hand separately and stick it on. So that, in a way, is karma, because what he's seeing then depends upon his past association with the Buddha image. If you've bowed to Buddha images, if you've, you know, made resolutions or wishes to a Buddha image, if you sat and meditated in front of a Buddha image, you'll have a different perception of it. You'll have a different feeling of the Buddha image, right? If you've done, you know, if you like Greek sculpture, when you come here, you'll see, well, what's the image made out of? How is it sculpted, etc.? Everybody sees something different. You may know I don't know if you've seen the Buddha bar in the UK, in Europe, and they have a bar selling beer and whiskey and everything else, decorated by Buddha images. And that's a different perception, right? So we go in and we see that, and we're like, ah, you can't do that. There's been, people have tried to get them to change or close down, but I guess it's freedom of speech or whatever. And they can still do it, so that's okay. So different people have a different perception. My example is, I was walking through the temple one time and I'd been around the back where they're working and I'd got myself a piece of wood. And I was walking back with this piece of wood. And there was a dog there, and the dog started to go for me, started to attack me. It was known as a bit of a vicious dog, this one, and it attacked a few people. Normally I walk past it, and it doesn't care about me, just ignores me, which is good. And this particular time, whenever you have something in your hand, you see, the dog feels threatened. And so it was starting to attack me, and I had to hide this piece of wood and shuffle along, and see, I wasn't prepared to trust my karma. I wanted to... if it's my karma to be bitten, I'll be bitten. And then, you know, you're going to get bitten with an attitude like that. So I'm not prepared to test my karma. And then I walked along a little bit further, and then I met the monk who looks after the novices. And he said, oh, you've got a stick to beat the novices with. And he was only joking, he wouldn't really beat the novices, but that was his idea because he's a novice teacher, right? A little bit further on, there was the monk who looks after the building of the place, and he saw me carrying this piece of wood. He said, what are you building? What are you making? Right? Now he's after my own heart because I was actually making something, and I wanted to make a shelf to go above my sink in the bathroom. And then I go on a little bit further, there's another dog there, but this dog, he likes to play, so he's like trying to bite my piece of wood and he's trying to play. Each time you see exactly the same thing. Here's me, 6 foot tall, thin, with a piece of wood in my hand, striding down the road. But each person or animal had a different perception of what it would see. And that perception depends upon their past actions regarding that thing, regarding the piece of wood, right? Depends on how they've interacted with wood in the past, what they perceive. So your perception of the world very much depends upon your past karma, on your actions. This is what you perceive in the world. Now you note here, this isn't what's happening to you. This isn't whether something falls on your head or whether something bites you or what, or etc. This is your perception of the world that you're carrying around in the present moment, that you've built up from the past. So your perception, I used to use this when I was younger, and I'd go out at night, and where I would go out was about 3 miles from where I lived, so there was always a long walk home. And whenever I saw a police van, you know what I used to do? Because the police is the same. If you're a good person, you see a policeman, you're like, oh, a protector of our society. And if you're a bad person, you see the policeman, you go, like this, right? So this was as a layman, of course, when I was younger. Whenever I was walking home and I'd see a police van, I'd immediately go, like this. And then I'd go, and I'd start walking a little bit stiffly. And then the police van would stop, because I'm looking suspicious, right? And after the police van stops, I say, can you give me a lift home? 2 out of 3 times I would get a ride home in the police van by doing this. So your perceptions, that's coming from your past, but that's very much you in the present moment. That's not the things that are happening to you. It's not whether it rained or it didn't rain, or what we call traffic light karma. You know, when you're in a rush, every traffic light is red, and you're like, this is the world, you know, against me. Do you know Calvin and Hobbes? Okay. Hobbes is the little tiger that Calvin thinks is real. He's a 6-year-old boy. Calvin and Hobbes are sitting under the tree one day, and Hobbes asks Calvin, do you believe in God? And Calvin goes, well, somebody's out to get me. This is traffic light karma. You think, oh, something's making all these traffic lights turn against me. And, you know, this is my karma. I'm paying for my past sins dearly today. That's what karma isn't. So karma isn't the outside world affecting you, and whether your car got stolen or didn't get stolen really depends on where you parked it and whether the keys are in there or whatever. I actually knew somebody who parked a car in a place in Manchester where you don't park your car. This is like, you know, you put something down for 2 minutes, it gets stolen. It's a really rough area of Manchester. And so she went and did her shopping, and she had a meeting, and then she rushed back because she was afraid that a car would get stolen. And true enough, she got back to the gone. And so she's, I knew it, you know, like, I shouldn't have come here, but I had to come here. So she calls the police, she calls her husband. The husband goes crazy, you shouldn't have parked your car. I know I shouldn't have parked my car. And the police are like, you shouldn't have parked your car here. I know I shouldn't have parked my car here. The next morning, the police phoned her up and said, we found your car, madam. She said, really, where is it? They said, it's still in the car park. She just had that perception that, hey, my car's going to get stolen. She'd gone rushing out, and she'd looked in the wrong spot. And there, and really, it was parked in the next bay, and it was still there the next morning, you know. If your car gets stolen, it's more likely about where you parked your car than it is about whether it's your karma or not. I can tell you another one. This is a brief thing. Whether the person would attribute this to karma or what, I don't know. But I was driving to work. I worked for my father at the time, and I had a car, and I never washed it. I was like any unkept kind of youth in England, never tidied his room, never cleaned his car. And the windows were filthy. And somebody wrote on the back window, don't clean me, plant something. I thought, now's the time to wash my car, I think. So I got to work, and I had this determination I was going to wash my car. And it just so happened I'd crashed my car sometime before, and I'd only just got it back from the repair shop. So, morning break comes, I've got 20 minutes break, and I have a bucket prepared, and my sponge prepared, and everything prepared. And so, when my break comes up in the morning, I go marching out of the back door, straight over, and I give my car a wash. And then I stand back, I'm like, oh, I feel it's so good, because when I'd gone to work that morning, I'd been reversing, and I couldn't see where I was reversing, because it was that, I thought, great, I can see through the windows. And then I look through the window, and there's like a toy on the back parcel shelf. I'm like, I don't remember that toy there. Oh, well. And then I stood back, admired my work, and I noticed that the repair shop had changed the wheel trims on my car. I'm like, hey, why did they change the hubcaps, right? Why did they change the hubcaps? And then I looked a bit closer. It wasn't my car. I'd washed somebody else's car. Now, I don't know if they believe in karma or not, but they would have come back to their car after shopping, and they see 200 cars in the car park. One car had been washed with all the suds around the bottom of it. And I'd be like, you know, who washed my car? So, I don't know how they would attribute that, whether they think that's karma or God or whatever. I don't know. But to get back onto the topic, the karma that you find in the suttas is always present moment, forward looking. The Buddha very rarely talks about vipaka karma, or the results of your karma, as in the past affecting you now. It's always you, what you do now affecting your future. And there's a subtle difference between these two. And to illustrate the difference, I want to bring up, just jump over slightly to psychology. And this should be able to show you quite what the difference is and why it's important. Freud, who was basically the grandfather of modern psychology, he had this idea, a very good and true and actually proven idea, even though Freud's theories are not widely accepted these days. He had this idea that if you have a problem of some kind, this problem has its roots in your past, especially from when you were very young. And there's good reasons for thinking this. For example, if you take a baby kitten, if a kitten has had a human being play with it in the first 6 weeks of its life, it will probably not be afraid of human beings for the rest of its life, excepting extreme circumstances of abuse or whatever. If a kitten has not been touched and handled by a human being in the first 6 weeks of its life, it will probably never be comfortable with a human being. It will always be scared of human beings. That's why you can't tame stray cats. You can only wait till they've had kittens, and then you get the kittens. You can tame the kittens, but you can't actually tame a stray cat. So that shows that sometimes something that happens to you when you're young has a big effect on your character when you're older, right? So Freud said it was something similar that's called imprinting, by the way, that it's something similar that happens with human beings, that certain things that happen to us when we're children go very deeply into our psyche, and then later on these things will have an effect on us, even though we can't remember the original problem. I'll give you another example. Do you know what the word gravity means? You do. Okay. How do you know what the word gravity means? Learned it in school. Okay. What day of the week was it when you learned it? Okay, good answer. Between Monday and Friday. Who was the teacher? What was their name? That's okay. It doesn't. I think everyone gets the answer. So you know what the word gravity means, but you have no idea how or where you learnt it, right? Probably in school, but maybe not. You don't know. So this is an example of something that you're carrying around with you now as a live, living part of your being, but you've no idea where it came from. This is what Freud said your character is. Your character is this seething mass of unconscious. And the unconscious is all the stuff that has happened to you that you can't remember. Your preconscious, or your subconscious, is the stuff that's happened to you that you can remember but is not in your mind. So, for example, do you know what pi is? What is the value of pi? Okay. Anybody? Okay, 3.14. How do you know that? Okay. But pi is there for, or for example, what is the nearest planet to the planet Earth? Yeah? Not a planet, is a the nearest planet or listed planet is Mars. Now I know that because I've learnt it and it's within my conscious grasp to remember that information. So that is information in my subconscious. That means that I can retrieve that information if I want. But most of the time I'm not thinking about it. Okay, I'm not thinking about the value of pi, which is 3.14, I think, right? But your unconscious is all the stuff that you can't remember, right? Is anybody afraid of spiders? Yes. I am. I'm petrified of spiders. And actually, I knew one guy in England, and he was converted to Buddhism in Thailand. And I said, oh, how did that happen? I was interested. He said, well, I was in a monastery. He said, and there was these two monks sitting there, and he said, and above one of the monks from the ceiling, this enormous spider, the size of a hand, started coming down on a thread. And he said, and do you know what that monk did? He said, the monk looked up at this spider, picked up his bag, stood up, moved three paces to the right, and he sat down again, like this. He said, seeing that converted me to Buddhism. It's a good job I wasn't sitting in that room under that spider. Have you ever blown up a balloon and then you let it go and it goes around the room? Yeah? That's me when I see a spider. If I'd been under that spider, that man would never have become a Buddhist. How did I get into that? Okay, so why are you afraid of spiders? According to Freud, something happened to you when you were younger that has made you afraid of spiders. One of the possibilities is you have a brother or a sister or a parent who was afraid of spiders, and they see a spider and they go, ah! And as a child, you draw on the emotions of the people around you, and if they're afraid, if your mother's afraid, then you become afraid. Right? Same as right now, if I suddenly jumped up and started going, ah, like this, or beating myself like this, you would all go, ah, right? Because you draw on the emotions of the people around you. So, all of your character, all of your being depends upon your past, according to Freud. This is what you are as a human being. There's a lot of truth in his theory, and there's a lot of proof of the theory also that we can prove. However, after a few years after Freud, there uprose this school, basically called the humanist school of psychology. And they said, it doesn't really matter what happened to you in the past, because you are a human being. You have power, you have control of yourself, and you can make decisions. And most importantly, you can change. And part of the reasoning they had for this was they would look at people who'd been in concentration camps during the World War or soldiers. And some soldiers would get back from the fighting and, you know, a bit of rest and a bit of home cooking and they're fine. And others would be seriously traumatized. And so they're asking, what is the difference? Why can 200, 300, or 3,000 people be in exactly the same situation, but their reaction, the way that they handle it, is totally different? Right? Now, according to Freud, if you're in that situation, you get that result. But the humanists said that isn't so. They said, as a human being, your character depends upon your hopes, dreams, and aspirations for the future, not from your past. So I have a friend, a close friend, and he was in... Are we running out of time? Okay. As a young child, he was brought up in Canada without any parents. He was an orphan. And in Canada at the time, if you were to accept an orphan into your family as a foster care, you would be paid money by the government. So a lot of the people that were taking children in that era were doing it for the money, not doing it for the children. So he had a really nasty upbringing. He'd get beaten, he was ignored, he was kind of abused, but the abuse of omission, like he wasn't given love, he wasn't given respect as a child. So he had a very bad upbringing. And this is a child, this is when you're at your most, the most influenceable, is that a word? Maybe we can invent that word today. Influenceable. It's not influential, is it? Impressionable, that's it. That's a better word. And yet, he's actually a Vipassana meditator. He's one of the people that I know with the most loving kindness. He's like, he's totally warm, he's kind, he's dedicated to Dhamma, he's dedicated to other people, he's unselfish, he's kindly. So the humanist school said it doesn't really matter what happened to you in the past, what really happens is your hopes, dreams and aspirations for the future. That's what's important, that's what generates your character. These days in modern psychology, actually, the humanist school has more of an influence than the Freudian school. People tend to look more towards the future than they do towards the past. So this was the same. This was the talk on the future of karma. And what it means is this. When the Buddha talked about karma, he wasn't saying that you have this big store of karma that's going to control or affect you. What he's saying is you have an action. Remember, karma means action. What actions you do now, deliberately, with intent, these are going to shape your future. Now, this is a huge difference, because this puts free will in your hands. And at one point he actually said, I teach the doctrine of free will, not the doctrine of determinism. Free will. There was actually a psychological test about free will, and whether your actions were determined by free will or not free will, and this psychologist proved that a lot of your actions are not done by free will, and somebody put up his hand, and so the psychologist, Susan Blackmore actually, she said, so why did he do this? And this man put up his hand and said, my free will made me do it. Buddhism is a teaching of free will, and if you take karma as being your action now affecting your future, this puts all the free will into your hands. If you take karma as being your past affecting you now, you've lost your free will. Because even if you decide to go to a meeting or go meditate or to do something good, well, that's just your past making you do it, right? You want to go and do a good deed for someone, well, that's like in the past, your past actions made this character and that's why you're doing it. And that wasn't Buddhism. That wasn't the way the Buddha was teaching. What he said was, you have total free will in the present moment. You have a freedom to choose and a freedom to act. When you choose, when you make a choice, that action is what's going to affect your future, not all the stuff that you did in the past. So there's a few more parts to the thing, but I think I'm going to stop there. And looks like a good time to stop. Does anyone have any questions or comments?
Anybody any questions? I'll bring on the mic.
Does anybody like to say they would save the crocodile or sacrifice the baby? Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Venerable, for the talk. Okay, so I'll be the first penguin to ask the question. Since you say that it's a free will thing, so and there's no predetermination according to Buddha's teaching, that means all the fortune telling and all whatsoever are bullshit.
Yes. Yeah, and again, as I said before, I can speak very confidently about the Buddha's teachings because I've read them, and usually I base things on the suttas. But when it comes to karma, it's a little harder to be certain. And my own teacher, he's like a jhana master, and he has all these psychic powers, and he can see into the past, and he can see where people are reborn and all these kinds of things. And he has this book about how Tolstoy was a reincarnation of Shakespeare, and like, wow, this is on a different level to myself. He says that karma is, everything is basically predetermined from your karma. He said even your free will depends on your karma. He also believes in astrology, you see. And I'm the opposite, even though he's my teacher. I don't hold to that particular view. But what I would say is that in his, and he's a, you know, real master, in his view, then astrology still works and is very real. So I would say that we can read the same books, we can read the same suttas, but we might have a different opinion on this question that you asked. So I'm giving you my opinion. I think it's either nonsense, or if it isn't nonsense, it doesn't matter. Does anyone know Peace Pilgrim? Anybody heard of Peace Pilgrim? Oh boy. Okay, next talk of Peace Pilgrim. She was a fabulous Christian lady who started walking in the US. She walked somewhere, I can't remember where. And she walked with just the clothes she was wearing, a spare pair of underwear and a tunic and a toothbrush. And when she got to where she was walking, she was like, meh, I don't care about this place. And she carried on walking. And she walked for the next like 35 years or something. And she never had any money. She never had any shelter or lodging. She never knew where she was walking to. She just walked and relied on the generosity of people. And very, very inspiring person. And one person asked her once, said, do you believe in astrology? And she says, I don't know about astrology, but do you really think I'm going to be pushed around by some little star? And I like that. You know, that's free will. That's determination, not determinism, right? That's free will. She was taking her fate into her own hands. So I would say it's all of this stuff is nonsense. But I know that we can read the same text and other people have a different opinion. So I'll leave it open like that.
Any more free will to ask the next question?
At the back here. I was going to talk about learning and in psychology how we learn with conscious attention. And lower animals are unable to learn new things, whereas the higher mammals are able to learn new things. And there's a lot of research gone into this. And I think this is important because if we take this Freudian view or this past karma view that, you know, we've got this big weight of our past that we're trying to deal with, then it's very hard to learn new things. But as a higher mammal, we have this ability to suddenly change course and make a very quick, very rapid, and very real change. I've got a few examples of this. One is the samurai crab in Japan, if anybody knows about the samurai crab. But another one is my friend's dog. And we used to take this dog down to the river. Basically, I like playing by the river, so the dog was an excuse to go down there. My mother would always scream at me for getting dirty. I'm like, well, we're taking the dog down. And next to the river was like the woods and the open area where you could go and walk around, and it's pleasant. And on the other side of the river were all these sheep fields full of sheep. And between them was the river. And at some point we decided the dog needed to learn how to swim. So we started throwing it in the river. And the dog got the hang of it and realized it could swim. And then every time we went down after that, as soon as we get down there, the dog was straight into the river across and we spend the next 3 hours chasing sheep while we're sitting, please come back, please come back, or trying to entice the dog back, you see. Now, it's a serious business, you know. Sheep, when they're worried like this, it can kill them. The stress can kill them. The farmers can, they actually have, by law, they can take a gun and they can shoot the dog. So it's a serious business. So we had to think of a way to stop the dog from crossing the river. Anybody have a suggestion? How do I do that? How do we do that? Anyone have an idea? Huh? On a leash? But it's a bit... Yeah, because this is a young dog. It liked running, and it's a bit sad to put it on a leash. I'm glad no one can think of the answer, because that makes me feel really clever. I took a plastic bag, a couple of sponges, a big bottle of shampoo, a brush, and a plastic, like, bin, you know, low, I don't know what you call it, container. And we kept the dog on the leash, and we walked all the way down to the river, keeping it on the leash. Went up to the river, and then I put the plastic thing just into the shallow part of the river. I got out my sponges, my brush, and my shampoo, and I took the dog, it's called Toby, and I said, okay, Toby, bath. That dog never crossed the river again. So, sudden change of perception, you see, a sudden change of course. And this is the idea, if everything depends on the past, well then, it knows that in the past it's crossed the river and it's had fun. But you can change the perception very quickly. And this is the same with your karma. If you're having bad karma, or if you feel you have bad karma, you can change very quickly your states of mind if you're making the right kind of decisions, which is called the four right efforts, actually. But you had a question?
Yes, Venerable. Thank you for the insight. I was thinking about the other day when I was reading the newspaper, I was thinking about the natural disasters in Japan. Well, I was trying to, you know, rationalize, you know, can this be karma? You know, now I maybe have some answer from you. I already had some answer from you. But then the Muslim, they interpret it as a test of God, you know. God testing you, you know. Taking such drastic action to test you, you know. So that maybe that's why they also have suicide bomber, you know. To test your, you know, test your belief, you know. So what is your perspective now? Well, taking karma aside, I was kind of confused on whether is that karma. Can it be karma? You know, when the disaster come, good people die, bad people die. You know, so now you sort of give me some insight. You know that there's some explanation, but what do Buddhists think about disasters? Natural disasters.
If that's a test from God, that's a pretty harsh test, right? A bit of advance warning and a bit of revision before you take a test is like normal. And a lot of people didn't get the chance, right, to test, you know, to practice for the test. And so it seems pretty unlikely or unimaginable to me that it can be anything that's been determined. Now, some people disagree, and I'm very much open to... the question, because I like questions more than I like answers. So some people say it's group karma or collective karma. But I think that's an easy way out. And basically, when something bad happens like that, what human beings want is an explanation. They want to make sense of it. And this is what Freud called rationalization. You want to find some reason, some way to make sense of something that just doesn't make sense. And it doesn't. Some people are killed, some people are born disabled or abused, some kids get leukemia. How can you explain all that? Really, you can't. That's just the workings of the natural world. And the natural world isn't kind, and it doesn't make very much sense, like rational sense. Now, there was a psychologist called George Kelly, and he was practicing Freudian psychology, dream analysis and stuff, on people, mostly blacks in Kansas in the Great Depression in the 1930s. And they were coming to him as a psychologist with problems that stemmed from extreme poverty and the collapse of the economy and the collapse of the currency. And they had no work, there was no food, there was, you know, this terrible situation. And they were poor, they're fairly uneducated people. And he was saying to them, like, what did you dream about last night? Right. And he started to... But the thing was, sometimes it would work. Sometimes he would help these people. And he was like, why does this kind of pseudo-scientific dream analysis, which is really like for middle-class, upper-class kind of people, sometimes work on these people? And what he started to realize was, it doesn't really depend upon the psychologist solving the person's problems. What they really wanted was just some kind of framework to understand what was happening. And this is when construct theory was born, personal construct theory. And I think that's what's happening when we start looking at natural disasters. You just want some kind of understanding, some kind of way of rationalizing the situation a little bit. And actually, I think in Buddhism, the real answer is samsara sucks, right? This is samsara and it sucks. It's unfair. You know, things great, you know, horrible things happen to great people and horrible people get great things happen to them and there are natural disasters and illnesses and it sucks, really does. And that's why we want to be practicing to absolve or resolve the whole issue of samsara. There's a curious phenomenon of a little bit, quite enough time to go into it, but very roughly, what we do is we create a symbolic world. We relate to things through symbols, because to try and think about everything is too difficult. So we have shortcuts or rules of thumb. In Buddhism, this is called Vedana. In psychology, these are called heuristics. And these are shortcuts to our understanding, so we use symbols as a guideline rather than figuring stuff out. But we invest so much in the symbols that after a while the symbolic world becomes our real world. Then when something bad happens, our own world is this shakable, unstable, uncertain, samsara sucks kind of universe that we live in, but the symbolic world is a lot more stable. And this is why whenever you have a natural disaster, people start to turn to religion, not from religion. Because you think, especially in Christianity, for example, you know, you think, well, why did God do this to us? You think it would turn people away from God. But actually, when you have a natural disaster, more people turn to God or start converting religions and things like that. Because the symbolic world, which is extraordinarily real to human beings, we live in a symbolic world, not in a real world. The symbolic world is more stable and it makes more sense. But that's a little bit of a complicated story. Maybe next time we can do that one. Okay, I think that's what we have time for. I think, okay.
Shall we give three bows to the Ajahn?